Jennifer Flagg perhaps expressed it best in her book Room for the Goats, when she said in a sermon that when she walked into this church for the first time in 1989, she knew within minutes that she had found the place where she belonged. "It is the church," she said, "which had room for the goats as well as the sheep." "Here is a whole community like me," she wrote, "who were bonded not just by a code of belief, but by a desire to follow their own spiritual path, and at the same time to give space and respect to the paths other people were following." For myself, it was not quite the same experience. It took a little while to adjust to "O God, our help in ages past," and "Onward Christian Soldiers," indeed to what at first seemed like a Protestant tone, which is perhaps still reflected in the half cups of free trade coffee offered after our services. But within a short time, like many of us, I knew this was my spiritual community, my tribe. And community, particularly a religious community, is the theme of this address. Community has been highlighted recently in the response of this congregation to great distress which has fallen on some of our fellow members. And we see it every Sunday and on other days in the voluntary contributions so many make to the church and in the many social activities. One member of this church, when at a low ebb, has a routine of imagining walking up the steps before service and greeting and being greeted by as many members of the congregation as can be remembered. It's an exercise which brings solace, and it highlights one of the many ways, however small, in which this congregation, this community, brings value to each of us. One definition of community says it is a body of people having common organization or interests, or who live in the same place under the same laws. Another description is a community is a social unit with shared socially significant characteristics such as place, set of norms, culture, religion, values, customs, or identity. Academics, of course, have delved into the meaning of community. Let's take one of them, Max Scheler, a German philosopher, who refines this definition even more. He outlines the ways in which a community is both like and unlike a family or corporation. And perhaps he could be describing Unitarianism when he sees the community as a sort of supra-individual with a mind and will of its own, which is in some sense distinct from the minds and wills of its individual members. Perhaps another way of putting it is that we live in each other's shadows. Ersko a Céile a Mhaoirn na Daoine, as the Irish saying has it. Kate Chadbourne on YouTube tells it well. We live in each other's shadow, in the shelter of one another, and not just in the sense that everything we do affects each other. We need each other, and we could add that we need community. Canon Hayes recognized this in 1937 when in Tipperary town he launched Muintir na Tíre with the core principles of neighborliness, self-help, and self-reliance, the emphasis being on local improvement, social, economic, cultural, and recreational. Today, Muintir supports 1,000 community groups nationally. A similar emphasis, although perhaps more economic, emerged with Father Mike Dyer in Donegal's Glencullum Kill. We could mention, too, the successful men's sheds, which have brought a sense of community albeit a purely male one, to many isolated men. And we remember in recent years Robert Putnam, in his book Bowling Alone, The Collapse and Revival of the American Community, which Jennifer referred to in her service. You may remember Bertie Ahern brought him over to Ireland 20 years ago to speak to Fianna Fáil. Putnam had noted the decline of social capital in the United States, how there were no third spaces where people could meet cheaply. There was a dearth of civic space. Due to car-oriented design and increased commercialization, it was harder just to hang out, unlike, say, in a Mediterranean village where people, barely consuming anything, would meet for a chat. People were choosing to engage in activities individually rather than communally, which was putting at risk, it was said, the United States' capacity to build social capital. In fact, The Guardian last week had a story about a group called More in Common, who say exactly the same thing is happening in Britain, where, because of COVID and social media and various other things, people are now bowling alone rather than together. And Putnam distinguishes between bonding capital and bridging capital. The first occurs among similar people, same race, religion, etc. And the second involves having the same activities among dissimilar people. Peaceful multi-ethnic societies require both, he says, and he could have said, so do healthy religious groups. Indeed, you could say that our relationship with Northern Ireland non-subscribing Presbyterians is a combination of bridging and bonding capital. And while some philosophers, of course, stress the importance of community, others emphasize that of the autonomous individual. But I'd like to think we have the balance right between both. Ultimate independence for the individual, but under the umbrella of our congregation, which motivates its members to be spiritual explorers, a description used by Aidan when referring to Teilhard de Chardin on May the 11th, rather, he said, than spiritual believers. We are defined, we could say, by our desire to explore, and ideally in this exploration, we accept that there may be disagreements about services, about hymns, governance, and personalities, both within our congregation and in the wider denomination. Such is the dynamism of a human spiritual organization. A look at two respected religious communities indicates the fissures within any community, whether secular or religious, are quite common. Community does not necessarily imply unanimity on everything. Quakers, the Society of Friends, from their heroic caring of the starving during the Great Famine to the 1798 rebellion when they fed and nursed the wounded, had many controversies and disputes. So Maurice Wingham tells us in his book, The Irish Quakers. In the 1800s, a breakaway group, the White Quakers, were formed. Members were disowned. There were criticisms of luxury, extravagance, and self-seeking, as the Quakers, you see, had become prosperous through hard work and their reputation for honesty. And at one time, something I didn't know, there were four White Quaker meeting houses in Clonmel, Waterford, Mount Mellick, and Dublin. They were, as Maurice Wingham writes, extremely Puritan, abhorring all forms of decoration, using only scrubbed or white painted furniture. Mirrors and watches were banned, and in their desire for truth, They even removed their clothing and went barefoot. The most extreme case was two girls who removed their clothes and walked through Longford town dressed only in chestnut leaves. We're told that the white Quaker settled down at an estate at Newlands in Clondalkin, where they supported themselves by gardening and, it is reported, growing grapes. I wonder, is the garden centre there a descendant of the white Quakers? But the whole movement only lasted 15 years. Dubliners may remember too how the charitable intent of the Quakers led to Victor Bewley and his brothers transferring the capital of the cafes to a community trust, the Bewley Community Limited, for the benefit of all working in the company. Of course, a more abiding memory might be the almond buns, coffee proffered, already milked, and the swirling tobacco smoke over the cake stands as the waitress asked you, "What did you have?" and the tables reserved only for staff. While members of the community could not gain personally from the shares, any income was used to promote the relief and employment of deprived people. The firm was sold in 1986. And we could look at the Methodists. Dudley Leveston Cooney, in his book The Methodists in Ireland, says it has been the practice for Methodists to go to the Church of Ireland to receive the sacraments. But an increasing number of them had no connection with the Church of Ireland, and so a demand rose for communion to be administered at Methodist meetings, leading to a rift for over 60 years from 1816, when what were called the primitive Wesleyans separated from the main body of Methodists. It would be a shame not to mention as well some of John Wesley's advice to preachers. "Be steadily serious," he said. "There is no country on earth where this is more necessary than Ireland. As you are generally encompassed with those who, with little encouragement, would laugh or trifle from morning to night." On this and every other occasion, Wesley said, "Avoid all familiarity with women. You cannot be too wary in this respect." And on hymns, and this is for the choir, he said, "Sing lustily and with good courage. Sing modestly, do not bawl." And of course, just like the Quakers and the Methodists, religions, as Bill Darlison has told us in his book, The Penultimate Truth, grow within a culture and help nurture a culture. Mancon McGann, in his fascinating book, 32 Words for Field, details an Irish culture which is all but gone. Rather than asking, "Not to, is it yourself?" people would ask, "Cé d'or thiabh tú?" Who are you of? In other words, from what community do you come out of? When the population of the Great Blaskets was forcibly moved to the mainland, life was a continual series of visits to other people's homes. There was even a special word for such visiting, scoriocht, and another word, botontiocht, which means visiting neighbours to hear old stories. And it was a world where many people believed in leprechauns and fairies. In 1937, over 100,000 children were asked to query their grandparents in regard to the little people. There are 375 accounts of encounters with leprechauns, 39 of them in Cork. Mancon himself was given what he was assured was a real leprechaun pipe, although I think he was sceptical when he saw Irish Trades Association stamped on the back of it. So it is perhaps no wonder that within that community and culture, there might have been a receptivity to certain aspects of Catholicism. Religions, as Bill Darlison said, grow with a culture which, Mancon McGann reminds us, had a widespread system of mehel or girth, where neighbours shared resources, cooperators in ploughing and hay harvesting, and lit fires on hilltops to ensure the help of Lug, the Celtic god, for a successful harvest. A look at monasticism is perhaps for another time. Emma Donoghue's book Haven gives a flavour of it in the 7th century. And the sharing of a communal lifestyle was adopted by some Christians in the early church. And then there were other more modern attempts to create Christian communities, such as the Society of Brothers, Bruderhof, Shakers, who didn't engage in sexual reproduction, and the Amana community, another one, the Farm, the Findhorn, which, like us, had no creed, and the Church of Armageddon. According to John Saliba, many such movements, which usually dwindled, had a strong leader, a rigorous system of social control and behavior, and were economically sufficient with members separated from the outside world. They have what Robert Putman referred to as bonding, not bridging social capital. So, to conclude, we can see that communities, whether religious or not, strive and are thrive in their surrounding cultural settings, whether it's John Wesley and his preachers struggling with their lack of Irish, Catholicism trying to regulate believers in fairies and fairy forts, or dissension among Quakers because of their increasing prosperity. And we've seen during the papal consistory how Catholics can be divided over doctrine and sex gender issues, a prime example being the spat between the official church and Catholic convert J.D. Vance, the U.S. vice president, over Ordo Amoris, the order in which one was obliged to dispense love and charity. For Vance, you love your family first, then your neighbor, then your community, then your fellow citizens in your own country. Then after that, according to Vance, you can focus on the rest of the world. Pope Francis, however, in a letter to US bishops, rejected any attempt to use Catholic theology to justify an immigration crackdown. People, he said, should meditate on the Good Samaritan. That is, by meditating on the love that builds a fraternity open to all without exception. And as Gavin reminded us 3 weeks ago, the future Leo XIV has also disagreed with Vance's view that love should be prioritized within one's community before extending it to others. Vance, he said, was just wrong. What Francis and Leo were emphasizing, perhaps, is that while we may live in different types of community, we are all part of one big community, humanity, a humanity which has its strengths and weaknesses, just like the various communities mentioned earlier, that we all live in each other's shadow, that we need each other, and that like Austin Clark's The Planter's Daughter, we share the same sky as those who live outside the house that is known by the trees. If we want to reflect on the health of this Unitarian community, a prayer from a Bradford, England service might be helpful. If you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to go far, go together. We have, I think, somewhat managed to do that, to go together. And we're all very reassured by a comment from another congregation member. When I am in this church, I feel I am the best version of myself. Thank you.